Renaud's not here tonight. He last week had bumped ahead a little bit over to chapter 14, if you want to turn over there, to another reference related to this figure that we came across back in chapter 7 of the 144,000. And there are some comments that are made about the 144,000 there that might be a little bit more where our Jehovah's Witness friends get their argument that the 144,000 are those that get to go to heaven, whereas others will just live on a rejuvenated earth. We'll note a couple of things that's said here, and then we'll just make some comments about that. Would someone read for us Revelation 14, verses 1 through 5? Would somebody read that? Okay.
Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his Father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of loud thunder, and I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. They sang as it were a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders, and no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. These are the ones who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no deceit, for they are without fault before the throne of God.
All right. Now, a couple of things we might observe about this. You'll remember back in chapter 7, we had this listing of the 144,000. And what was characteristic of those that were listed there in chapter 7 in terms of nationality? What would we say about them? Right, they're all Jews. They are all of the tribes that are mentioned. Unless we are talking about it in spiritual terms, and it's speaking there of the spiritual Israel, it mentions specific tribes, Gad, Asher, etc. Now, with that being said, a couple of things that we have to observe here in chapter 14. We somewhat assume we're talking about the same 144,000. I don't have much problem with that. But we probably should note, unless I've missed something before or after this in our reading, I don't think we have anything, at least in this section, verses 1 through 5, that absolutely say it's the same 144,000. Now, I don't have any problem if it is, but just note that the text doesn't say those 144,000 that were mentioned earlier in the book are the 144,000 of the tribes of Israel. Now, that being the case, if it is the same or if it isn't the same, maybe inconsequential. But probably the reason that some of our Jehovah's Witness friends will argue what they do, notice there in verse 4, speaks of these who were redeemed from among men. Into verse 3, those who were redeemed from the earth. Now, they may look at that and say, okay, well, this is talking about those that are before the throne. They were redeemed from the earth, so they're not going to have to live on this rejuvenated earth. Understand when I use that term, rejuvenated earth, that's the position that the Jehovah's Witnesses take, that salvation for the vast majority will simply be life on an earth very much like this, that is a rejuvenated earth. Now, Scripture does speak of a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells, but that is the same as the tabernacle of God being with men, the habitation of God being with men. So there doesn't seem to be this kind of distinction. Now, with what's said here, is this suggesting that there's this special group that gets to live with God in heaven, but others don't? I don't think this term that's used there at the end of verse 3 should be understood in that way at all. You know, in the fact that all of us live here upon earth, anyone who is redeemed from their existence here upon earth could be said to be redeemed from the earth. It's not a sense that they don't have to live in the same place or that they get a special kind of appointment. Now, with that said, I think also it may be, if we are talking about the same from chapter 7, that this is simply addressing those who were of the Jews who did accept the gospel. A vast majority of them didn't, but here some from among the Jews that did. But notice it says something in particular about them. What does it say there in verse 4? Something about their choice with respect to their lifestyle. Virgins, right. They didn't marry. Now, this may well be why some in church history have kind of exalted the idea of celibacy, but I don't even think that's the idea here so much. It's probably the very kind of idea that 1 Corinthians 7 talks about with those that marry facing certain hardships, particularly in times of persecution, those that would marry face certain kinds of hardships. These who are kind of the first fruits, these who are faithful to the Lord, these may have some sort of special relationship with the Lord. They may have some special honor of being able to be with God. But I don't think we see here some distinction that, all right, these are ones that go to heaven. These are ones that live on the rejuvenated earth. Now, I think the thing that Brother Renaud had asked about here was the issue where it mentions there in verse 3 that they are they sang a new song before the throne. And this is a song that no one except the 144,000 can know. I don't have a real good answer to that. It may be somewhat of a contrast between the song of Moses that was connected with Israel. And here, if these are the same from chapter 7, these are Israelites, but in a new relationship with God now, who sing a new song and have this new song. Why it said that only they can learn this song, I don't know specifically. It may just simply be that this is part of an honor that is given to them because of what they endured and what they went through. Now, again, we kind of jumped ahead, and I kind of wanted to do that for Brother Renaud, but unfortunately he's not here. Thoughts or comments or questions about that reference to 144,000? All right, one other thing that I wanted to look at before we get into chapter 8. You may remember from some of the things that we were looking at earlier in the book, there's been several times where reference has been made to the seven spirits of God. Brother Harville pointed out something that I think his father-in-law had pointed out to him in some discussions that he had with him. Now, am I remembering right? It's chapter 11 of Isaiah. Was that the chapter? Okay. If you want to notice, in the first few chapters of Revelation, there are times that reference will be made to these seven spirits. And you'll even see that when the throne scene is presented, where you have the 24 elders around them, their reference will be made to these lamps that are the seven spirits of God. Now, we made the argument, and I think it's still a pretty good argument, that the way that language is used in Revelation often is simply using that number seven, not numerically, but of the completeness of the Spirit of God, the revelation of God. And one of the reasons that I think that argument has some validity is because if you look at what's said through the letters to the seven churches, it is the Spirit speaking, but it is sometimes almost treated as if it is a spirit of this particular church. Now, back in Isaiah chapter 11, though, there is something that's kind of interesting, and it may have a bearing on this understanding of the seven spirits. And it is a statement that's made in connection with messianic prophecy. But let's take a look at it. Would someone read for us, please? And we'll take it down to about verse 3 of Isaiah chapter 11. Someone volunteer for that? Dave? Now, I mentioned Sunday night how so many things in our Romans class and our Revelation class are meshing together very well. We've just talked a little bit in our Romans class about how there are times that Scripture will speak of spirit in the sense of disposition, attitude. Here, you see that so clearly as verse 2, as it, well, let's back up. Verse 1, who is this root and stem of Jesse? Jesus, right. He's one that is that comes forth from David, comes forth from, of course, Jesse being the father of David, but it's also at the root of that, because you're talking about one that is divine. So here, as it talks about Jesus, verse 2, it says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon him, but notice it mentions these other things as well that are not. We shouldn't understand them in the sense of, okay, here's this separate entity that is wisdom, this separate entity that is might. But here, each of these describes an aspect or a disposition, an attitude, might, understanding, strength, knowledge, fear of the Lord. Now, what's interesting, Brother Harville pointed this out, You look at the number of those things that's mentioned here, beginning with Spirit of the Lord, and you come up with the number 7. Now, it may simply be here as well that this is used in the sense of completeness, that you have these qualities that are described, and beginning with the Spirit of the Lord being upon them, you have these complete attributes that are associated with it. But there may be some connection, and it may be that it's used in a similar kind of way. Thoughts or comments or questions about this reference to the spirits of the Lord or the Spirit of the Lord here as it is in Isaiah 11?
Interesting.
It is interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I think you had also pointed out the, what was the other point that you made? Was it from Proverbs?
Somewhere in Proverbs, it speaks about the 7 abominations before the Lord.
Yeah. Very, very good points. Any other thoughts or comments? All right, go to Revelation chapter 8 then, and let's dig in. And you'll remember that we have been noticing that there are several cycles of sevens in the book. There are 7 churches that are addressed at the beginning. There are 7 seals that are opened. And in our consideration here, when we first began looking at chapter 8, we have the 7th seal opening, which leads right into the next cycle of sevens. And I think I made a point near the very end of our class last week that often, either in the vicinity of 6 or 7, what you have is kind of resolution. Because you'll have within the first of the cycles, now this is not true necessarily of the letters to the 7 churches, but when you have these trumpets, and then you have the seals. You'll have conflict, you'll have persecution, you'll have hardship, and then there's resolution to that that's described. Here, the 7th is not necessarily that same way, because in some ways, back at the end of chapter 7, you had a little bit more of the resolution. But as it begins here in chapter 8, you're definitely not talking about something that is the same sort of confusion or hardship. Let's have someone read that for us again, please. Verse 1 down through verse 6. Volunteer for that. Verse 1 through verse 6. Anybody? Okay, Patrick.
When he opened the 7th seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the 7 angels who stand before God, to them and given 7 trumpets. Then another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense, with the prayers of the saints, ascended before God from the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and threw it to the earth. And there were noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. So the 7 angels who had the 7 trumpets prepared themselves to sound.
Okay. So here, as the 7th seal is open, there's silence, and that ushers in this next cycle of sevens that begins with the trumpet sounding. Now, I don't have an awful lot to comment on that reading. We had read it last week, but are there any thoughts or comments that anyone wants to make about that first section of chapter 8? Patrick? That is interesting, isn't it?
I mean, you're in the Spirit, you're telling these prophecies and all these wondrous things, and I can see silence.
Yeah.
But then there's silence for a half an hour.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm not sure how to take that.
I'm inclined to think that this is the perception that John has as he is in this condition. That's an odd thing, I think, with respect to how deity perceives time. You know, I've heard some say, well, there is no such thing as time with deity. I don't know that that's exactly accurate, because deity does know that there's a progression of events that happens. The difference with deity is that deity can see the past and the future and the present simultaneously. I think the idea here may simply be that in that which we understand to be an hour, John is allowed to see these events, whether they are portraying the spiritual reality that exists at present or he is seeing things that will take place in the future. There is a span of a half hour that takes place within his lifetime or his perception. At least that's the way that I would understand it. Brother J.H.?
If time is not important,
then timing.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point. Yeah. Certainly there will be a point at which our opportunities come to an end, a time at which the chances that we have to obey will come to an end. And in all of our lives, even if we have made good use of the opportunities and time that we have, our life is temporary. And when you're talking about deity, though, you're talking about one that's eternal. And one of the most difficult concepts about the eternal nature of God, not only the fact that he will continue to exist eternally, but that he has always existed eternally. And I don't know how to perceive that. I don't know how to grasp, wrap my mind around that. But there's really no alternative to that. Because if you're talking about, and I've mentioned this before, a Sikh friend that I had that really struggled with that. Said, well, if that just can't be, because who made God? And, you know, even if you want to say, okay, well, someone made God, well, who made the one that made God? And it just goes back eternally. And you have to, it's kind of like when we talked about, is there evidence that God exists here several weeks ago? That argument that everything is in motion and you have to have a first mover to start everything going. Same thing is true with respect to God. He is the one that moves everything but is unmoved. He is the one that exists and can bring things into existence. And as difficult as it is to perceive, that's the reality that we're faced with. But Patrick?
Well, one of the reasons I asked that, too, is the more and more I thought about it, you're talking about an innumerable number of popes, 144,000, whatever they are, 24 elders, and the four images, or whatever they are.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'll think about your experience,
the passage, the Lord's in his holy temple, and all the earth keeps silence before him. You know, there's a sense of something's going to happen here, and that certainly expresses that. And that is hard to fathom as well. You're talking about this number, the 144,000, and those outside of those as well. Remember back when we saw that in chapter 7, you're talking about an innumerable company that is here before the throne, and yet there's silence. You know, that just doesn't happen in our perception. Brother Munden?
In verse 3, is he speaking of Christ, or is this just symbolic? It says, another angel came to visit the altar, having the golden censer, and there were given unto him much incense, and he should offer it with the prayer of all the saints. Is he speaking, is that just symbolic, or is he speaking of Christ?
Well, I had not thought of it in the sense of Christ. I suppose if we were thinking of it that, well, Christ is the one that intercedes in prayer, then only Christ really is in that position. But I don't know that we have to understand it in that sense. I would take it either symbolic or, you know, the operations of heaven. We don't understand all that goes on in terms of the operations of heaven. And the intercession of Christ is not compromised if there is some operation of angelic beings that moves that message to Christ, or that off, you know, presents that to him, and it goes to the Father through him. So, you know, there are certainly times in which the term angel can be used simply of a messenger, and Christ can be a messenger of God in that sense. Christ is not simply an angelic being, again, the way our Jehovah's Witness friends like to think of him, that he's just an exalted angel. I wouldn't take it in that way. I don't know, anyone else have any thoughts on that reference to the angel and his incense here being the prayers of the saints? All right, let's move to the next section then. And I probably won't spend too much time with this. If I skirt over something that we need to address, stop me and we'll spend some time with it. But could I get someone to just read from verse 7 down to the end of the chapter for us? Volunteer for that? Okay, Chuck.
The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood. And they were cast upon the earth. The third part of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. The second angel sounded, as it were a great mountain burning with fire, was cast into the sea. The third part of the sea became blood. The third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died. Third part of the ships were destroyed. The third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. It fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of the waters. The name of the star is called Wormwood. The third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men died in the waters because they were made bitter. The fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten. The third part of the moon and third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound.
Okay. Now, I would remind you, a couple of weeks ago, we spent quite a bit of time going back and looking at some instances where God has communicated things in the past. We looked at some things related to Pharaoh's dreams. We looked at some things related to Joseph's dreams. And I can't help but look at these and be reminded of that model. Now, the reason that I think that's important is if you use those as a model of God's communication regarding future events and regarding revelation of things, you're not going to be too troubled with going, all right, what date was it that a mountain fell, and what date was it that you have all these, you know, then you're not as troubled by that, because you see these as broad figures that communicate certain things. Now, there are going to be an awful lot of sources. You listen to a lot of folks on radio and television. You look at a lot of commentaries, and they won't use that as kind of a model. Instead, what they will try to do is look at points in history past or make predictions about future events and try to say, okay, on this date, or this is saying that this nation is going to fall and this is going to happen. And they take some of these references to death and those that die in a very literal way. I'm much more inclined to think that what we're looking at here, following the same cycle that we saw back in the previous chapters, hardship, persecution, things that happen that are horrible here in this life, here in this world, but it's all leading us up to, again, a resolution of this in the fact that God is ultimately in charge. I'm continually reminded of Jesus' statement, in this world we'll have tribulation, but he's overcome the world. And I think to people that are in the midst of persecution, things such as this, they can relate to all of these kinds of things happening. Some have made connection with some of the things that are stated here to some of the events that ultimately would lead to the fall of Rome. One commentator observed the fact that there were kind of different factors that led to the fall of Rome, both external factors, both calamities, both internal immorality and things like that. And he made sort of a connection with some of the things that are said here in that regard. And that, there may be some validity to that, but I'm much more inclined to just kind of see these things as descriptions of hardship, calamity, these kinds of things that will happen and will come and will be horrible, But God will deliver us from those, whatever that may be. The reference there in verse 11. Now I didn't point this out. Notice we're looking at verse 7, first trumpet. Verses 8 and 9, second trumpet. Verses 10 and 11, third trumpet. Verses 12 and 13, then you have the fourth trumpet that's sounding. There in verse 11, where we have the third trumpet, reference is made here to wormwood. And if you go and you look in Deuteronomy, you look at a few passages in Jeremiah, you'll see a connection made with wormwood and the influence of idolatry, the influence of the destructive power of pagan religion. And it may be that there's somewhat of a connection that's being made here in the fact that their immorality, their wickedness, leads to these kinds of things that end up bringing about their own ruin. And I think that may well be why we're looking at this reference to wormwood here. Thoughts or comments or questions down through the end of chapter 8? Joe?
Is it possible that he's using some of these terms that they're familiar with from history to explain what the future is going to be like? Not necessarily exactly locusts coming in just right, but in time past, the plagues of Pharaoh, and you know the locusts, you have the same kind of famines going on. Not necessarily because of locusts, but they understood, you know, one of these code words or something.
Yeah. Possibly. And, you know, one thing that might really have an impact on them with regard to that, if you compare it to some of the events of times past, you compare it to what they're going through. I suspect that some of the Christians here during the time in which Revelation was written were thinking to themselves, the world is falling apart. Because here we've named the name of Christ and the whole empire is against us now. And yet what you see here in these statements in Revelation is, you know what, there are going to come some things that are even worse than this. And so, while that's kind of an odd sort of comfort to people that feel like everything is bad now, it's almost like what you saw near the end of the book of Daniel. You remember in the book of Daniel, here Daniel spans from this time with the Babylonian captivity into the Persian period, and some of these people that had been in this time period would have experienced the deportation into Babylon, and some would be able to experience the return back to Persia. And to these people that had faced such difficulty, they're told near the end of the book of Daniel, there's a time coming in which it's going to be even worse. That's almost what you see here. And I think it's somewhat offered kind of as a source of comfort to them, but ultimately a realization that even if things get worse than they are now, God's still ultimately going to prevail. I think you may be absolutely right that some of those same figures are kind of associated with it in terms of what happens, the kinds of hardships, the kind of plagues that happen. Even those that are in power now will be brought down, and they'll experience this fall of their power. Went to the meeting Monday night in Dumas, and Brother Adams made an interesting point with respect to some of these references that we'll find throughout to heavenly bodies falling. And he made a point, I don't know that I ever heard expressed in exactly that way when he was, I think he was in Isaiah in some places where that end times language or eschatological language that uses references to the moon being turned to blood and the sun being darkened. And he made reference to the fact that sometimes that may be speaking of authorities and leaders and earthly figures in the sense of luminaries that are brought down and humbled. And I thought that was kind of an interesting point. There are many times, I think, in which that may have a bearing. I still like the idea, and I'm going to cling to it until somebody knocks it out from underneath my legs, the idea that God, in His ability to see the future, the present, and the past simultaneously, often in dramatic situations, in monumental changes, will use language that looks ahead to what will happen one day in reality. And not so much, not just the idea of hyperbole, but saying the earth will be shaken, the moon will turn to darkness, the sun will turn to darkness, kind of looking ahead, looking at the present situation, but also somewhat looking ahead. I think Matthew 24 does that to a certain extent. Any other thoughts or comments? Chuck?
I just still go back to verse 17 of chapter 7 and others that will come later. Mm-hmm. That all of this boils down to the encouragement of what it's going to be like eventually.
That's right.
And that is that God's going to lead us to living fountains of water.
Yeah.
And wipe away all tears.
That's absolutely right.
And all of these calamities that you may suffer, just think about that.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. And these cycles, you know, as many things in the book of Revelation that you'll see that are frightening and horrible, they always culminate in God will wipe away every tear. Yeah, and all the way leading up to the very end of the book where you have that ultimate declaration of heaven and earth fleeing away from the throne and the dead being resurrected and things such as that. On this idea of that we were talking about a little while ago with offering comfort to people in hardship by telling them about greater hardship. That may seem a little odd, but don't we do that to our children sometimes? I know with my own children, when they may be going through a difficult time, sometimes to try to help them understand this feels difficult now, I may talk to them about something that they're going to face in the future that'll be worse. Now, someone might say, well, doesn't that discourage them? Well, not necessarily. It kind of puts things in perspective. Now, you know, you also try to offer to your children exactly what we see here, that there'll be a better day. It's hard now. It's difficult now. You don't like it now. But there'll be hardships that are worse, but there'll be things that are great as well. And I wonder if that isn't a little bit what we're looking at in the book of Revelation. Because those that are facing this persecution can look at this and go, all right, there'll be deliverance. God will deliver us. He had forgotten us. You know, it's not that everything's falling apart. Instead, we're on the winning side. Any other thoughts or comments? Questions? Brady?
In what sense would have been made if a Roman soldier had picked up this letter or a Roman leader had picked up the letter and read it? I think it would have been viewed as sheer babble.
Or at the very least, they might think that they're somehow deluded or they're living in a fantasy world. Whereas in reality, this is describing the spiritual condition of those that are with God in Christ. And we need to gain the same kind of comfort from it that I'm most certain that they did. Any other thoughts? Joe? And they'd certainly see there were some of their brethren that were a part of this, 144,000, if nothing else.
Exactly. Yeah. All the religions toward Moses and the law, and realizing that even the Christians still accept Moses and the law as being from God.
Right.
And it changed, but you know, they still recognize that all of that.
That's right. That's right. Well, let's look a little bit in chapter 9 and at least touch on the first part of it. And I want to offer to you, even before we read this, something for you to think about as we read through it. And we'll probably just be able to read it and then pick up with it week after next. I think we have singing next week. You're going to have reference made to this one who is king over these creatures that are described coming out. Now, as you initially read it, you might think that this is either a figure of some literal hardship. Locusts. There certainly have been times where locusts have been a real hardship in a literal way. But the reference that's made, particularly when you get to verse 11, makes me wonder a little bit if we're talking in even in literal terms about some sort of hardship or if we are talking about spiritual kinds of ways in which there's hardship that comes upon the earth. Would somebody read for us, please, verse 1 down to verse 12, and that'll probably do us on time. Verse 1 through verse 12. Volunteer for that. Brady?
Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to the earth. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit, and he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke, locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. They were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth, or any green thing, or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. In those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. The shape of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were crowns of something like gold, and their faces like the faces of men. They had hair like women's hair, and their teeth were like lion's teeth. And they had breastplates like breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. They had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails. Their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has the name Apollyon. One woe is past. Behold, still, two more woes are coming after these things.
Okay. Both of these names there in verse 11 make reference to destruction. The reason that I pose kind of the question for you to think about is, in what sense would we think about one who is the angel of the bottomless pit, who, you know, if you know anything about things that are described later in the book, who would you guess this is talking about?
Satan.
Satan is the one associated with the bottomless pit. In what sense would you think of locust or some literal creature having Satan as a king over them? You know, you don't see that described, although there are spiritual forces that Satan is said to be king over, to have authority over. Now, whether you're thinking of that in terms of evil, sinful powers of the earth, Rome or whoever it may be, that operates to harm men, or if you are talking about demonic forces that harm men. One thing I think it's particularly interesting, the end of verse 10, this is limited. It's not that they have any kind of power that is ultimate or lasting or continuing. Let's pick up right there next time. Thank you for your thoughts and comments.